Here at the podcast over the years, we've learned a lot from our winemaker friends in Napa. When Dan Petroski came, he told us about cutting his teeth at Larkmead and learning about Cabernet and how Larkmead had a cool experimental block of clones.
So I went in full steam ahead, and for 6 straight years, I worked in the cellar of Larkmead by myself. We don't make a small amount of wine, 8,000 to 10,000 cases a year. And except for harvest, I was the only person in that cellar doing all the day-to-day work.
That sounds like a lot.
I didn't think it was a lot until people told me it was a lot. That was, and I still didn't believe them because I was like, it's Cabernet. Cabernet's pretty self kind of, you know, self-fulfilling. You harvest, you ferment, you barrel down, you rack and blend, and you sit and watch. And I didn't watch, I tasted. And that's how I learned wine. That's how I learned Larkmead. I tasted every single moment that I could, was taste and taste and taste.
Well, recently we called up some of our sommelier friends to see what really gets them excited about Napa Valley wines. For a limited time, a bunch of them are cherry picking some of their favorite Napa Valley wines and pairing them with the specialty burgers at their restaurants. The idea, called Somms and Sliders, brings two great things together: passion for wine and delicious burgers. Mia Vanderwater over at North End Grill has a tasty Somms and Sliders option.
Hi, this is Mia Vanderwater. I'm the wine director at North End Grill in New York City. We are huge fans of older vintages of Napa Cab at North End Grill, particularly the late 80s and early 90s, because there's just amazing maturity and complexity and nuance once they've got a little time in the bottle. But for the Somms and Sliders promotion this fall, we're pouring 2012 Heights Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon with Chef Eric Korsch's short rib burger with chipotle mayonnaise. I love classics. I think they're classic for a reason, and I can't think of anything better than a great burger and a really incredible classic Napa Valley Cabernet.
Mia, you had me at chipotle mayonnaise. Can I just get like a quart of that and put it on everything? So folks, you know what to do. Check out everything going on with Somms and Sliders and taste your way through some special hand-picked Napa Valley bottles. To learn more about how sommeliers are using Napa wines in restaurants, in particular with burgers, visit www.sommsandsliders.com. SOMMSANDSLIDERS.
Some really big news from 750. They've announced online ordering. Ordering on 750 is more than just simply adding items to a shopping cart. It's actually a complete order management system that streamlines the process of creating, sending, and tracking all of your orders to all of your multiple distributors. The best part of all of this is that it's designed to fit into your existing email ordering process, the one you already have, and you get to still work with the same distributor sales reps that you always do, but now there's less confusion for everyone because what you have intended to order becomes automatically generated with detailed product information inside of the message. Also, order history with each distributor is stored on 750. That way you can easily reorder previously purchased products with just a simple click. This is the greatest. It's exactly what everyone has always wanted in this profession. And if you're excited to be working simpler and with less confusion, 750 has you covered with a great new ordering platform. If you have not already signed up for 750, you should check it out. 750.com has more information about a better way to do business with less headaches and more effectiveness. Check it out. 750.com is going to save you time and make you more effective at what you already like to do.
I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Possibly from northern Italy and Veneto, and growing under a variety of different names from northern to mid-Italy, Verdicchio has made itself at home in the Marche. In the Marche, Verdicchio can have a unique symbiosis with Malvasia and Trebbiano, where the grapes in trio can create a unique, mysterious, and age-worthy wine. It can also be bottled on its own and can be truly ethereal with some age. Verdicchio has been confused with Trebbiano often in the past, but especially with DNA profiling, the story of Verdicchio is becoming ever clearer. In fact, Verdicchio's past helps clarify some of the passions and motivations of people living in Italy in the 15th and 16th centuries. Verdicchio moved around North and Central Italy during a few centuries when the Italian peninsula suffered multiple plague outbreaks. Some outbreaks would be small, hitting a few hundred people in a localized area. And when an outbreak happened, little spots, lentil-like spots, would show up on the skin, and then lymph nodes would swell, and rarely would anyone live beyond the fifth day of catching the disease. Usually, if one person in the house contracted the plague, everyone else in the house would catch it and die around the same time. It was just devastating. Outbreaks swept across Europe, leaving hundreds of thousands dead in the wake. In this time of uncertainty, a time when you're constantly reminded of humankind's mortality, and a time when entire populations searched for a greater meaning in it all, some of the greatest art was born. During one of the most devastating plague outbreaks in the mid-1300s, called the Black Death Pandemic, that claimed millions of lives, during this time, Giovanni Boccaccio wrote the Decameron. This book is set just outside of Florence in a deserted villa during a plague outbreak. The 10 characters in the book hunker down outside the city to ride out the plague. The villa was likely empty because its owners probably were plague victims, and its new inhabitants told stories to wait out the Florentine epidemic and hopefully avoid infection to save their own lives. The basic premise of the story, that we all probably read in high school, highlights some of the social unrest that motivated people in the 1300s to 1600s during plague outbreaks. People wanted to leave cities during the outbreak. Empty houses and villas were there for the taking. People were dying left and right, and this caused many people to act differently than they may have in non-plague times, acting impulsively, living in the moment. But perhaps most tellingly, as the book's frame story shows, many people just wanted to move out of urban plague zones and take cover in less populated areas. In the 1300s through the 1600s on the Italian peninsula, many migrations of people, and the grapes they took with them, were motivated by plague outbreaks. From 1576 through 1577 in Milan, for example, the city recorded over 17,000 plague deaths, and this same plague outbreak in Venice was responsible for 50 to 60,000 deaths. I mean, just imagine that much of a city's population just being wiped out within a year. The outbreak from 1576 to 77 was one of the worst to hit Italy since the Black Death pandemic in the 1300s. A doctor in the Marche, Marino Masucci, who wrote about the 1576 plague, described a pandemic that swept through cities. He distinguished between different types of sicknesses that were often lumped into one disease by doctors. And Masucci himself may have been taking refuge. He formerly practiced in Padua, then stayed in the Marche during the outbreak, but he also may have been motivated to return to his home of Jesi after studying and practicing in the north. It was just before this plague outbreak that Masucci described when Verdicchio was first mentioned in the historic records of the Marche. Who was the first person to bring Verdicchio to the Marche? And when they planted their cuttings in the Marche, was the vineyard a memorial to an abandoned past, a dead past? Did the vines remind them of a better, plague-free time from their home in the north? When the motivation to move for your life, is so strong that you pack up for good, move your family, and think to bring some vines with you for the long haul, the grapevines, they become more than just a food source. They become a symbol of identity. It's likely that Verdicchio traveled across various parts of Italy, likely moving north to south, during the social unrest caused by the plague across the four centuries from the 14th through 17th centuries. In fact, as we use genetics to trace Verdicchio's path across Italy, Verdicchio helps tell a larger story of the human condition during a time of great strain. In Verdicchio, you'll not only find great wine, you'll find hints of the indelible human spirit.
La Distessa is a winery that impressed me right away from the first time I tried the wines. Because when they're on, they touch on something sublime. Not just fruit and nuance, but also energy and presence on the palate as well. Plus, the wines develop nicely in the bottle. There's a chestnut honey character that comes out in Terracevate that I like a lot. The Terracevate is mostly Verdicchio, but more savory than a lot of Verdicchios can be. And it's true that the wines from La Distessa are really their own thing when you compare them to others in the region. That's part of why I like them so much, and that's why I'm happy that the team at Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan has sourced some Terracevate to offer you at a discount. I don't get to see the La Distessa wines everywhere, and when I do see one, I usually order it right away because, frankly, they're pretty rare in the market. As a listener of this podcast, you can go ahead and get some La Distessa Terracevate for yourself if you'd like to, and it's pretty easy. Crush is offering the 2015 to you as listeners for $28.95 a bottle. Usually it's a wine that goes for $32.95 a bottle, but you listen to the program, and that means you get a discount. If you'd like to take advantage of the special pricing, all you need to do is call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTTFORME, or use that same promo code online at crushwineco.com. You can also send me an email at levyopenswine@gmail.com. It's Levy with an I, openswine@gmail.com. If you want to join our wine club, and we'll make sure some of the La Distessa wines that I like so much make their way to you. Corrado Dottori of La Distessa in the Marche of Italy. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Nice to have you here. So your first vintage at La Distessa was in 2000.
Yes. My first harvest, 99, but I was still living in Milan. And then we moved in March 2000. My first vintage was 2000.
And what brought about that move? Why did you decide to move from the city to the country?
It's a good question. I grew up in Milan, and I studied there, and I graduated in economics.
So not winemaking?
No, absolutely not. And I began to work in a bank, an international bank. And then this was the end of the 90s. So it was the period of the boom in the Nasdaq, and all the finance system was really booming. And everybody was asking for stock options, and it was a very crazy world. And my family, they were from the Marche region. So they owned these small pieces of land. But my father was an engineer, so he left the region in the 60s and 70s. And so we grew up in Milano, me and my brother. And this land was rent to farmers that took half of the production working in the fields. So at that period, in the end of the 90s, I thought that could be like a dream to change my life and try to do this experience. So going back to my father's land and try, I was already, you know, not an expert, but, you know, a lover of wines. And so with Valeria, my wife, we decided to change our life.
So what was your first move when you arrived in the Marche?
The idea was, at the beginning, was not really to make wine, but was to change our life. So we went to live in this house that was not a ruin, but there weren't people living there since 20 years. So we began to restore a little bit the house, and we opened a small bed and breakfast, like a farm holiday. So we began with that, and of course with the wine, but we only had 1 hectare at the moment. The vineyard that my father planted in 1980.
And it was Verdicchio.
Yeah, because Cupramontana is so called the capital of Verdicchio. So 90% of comes from Verdicchio grape.
So that's a nice head start, though, in the fact that you start and you get 20-year-old vines. I mean, it's only a hectare, but...
If you start a business and you start from zero, it's much more complicated, of course. So I have to thank my family and my parents because they never sold these properties, you know, even if they lived very far, because from Milano is about 5 hours drive, you know. Yeah, it's like to maintain your route, you know.
So you go back, and then what was it that you decided to make wine? I mean, obviously you had vines, but what was the move there? What was the change?
In Italy, and not only in Italy, probably all around the world, but especially in Italy, that was the time of the super Tuscans, of, you know, the great wine, super, super concentrated, and with a lot of winemaking, you know? And the only real thing that I knew at the time about wine was, you know, how to taste it. I took some courses, and so for me, the wine world was something very, very, very fancy, very, the fancy wine, the all this kind of stuff. And so what I did was to take a winemaker, and I bought some stuff for the cellar. So we had these very old barrels, and we took all off from the cellar, and we bought the stainless steel, new machines, and we began to make wine in the way that at the moment we thought was the way, you know? I only had one law in mind, that was, I want to be organic. To make something which is safe for people and for the nature, you know. So this was the first step. But otherwise, of course, working with a winemaker, everything in the cellar was a little bit about cleaning everything, about control everything, about the you know, the fermentation with the right yeast, and you know what we know. What winemaking is. And so I started in this way.
Did you like the taste of the wines?
Yes. The wines were good and were authentic. I mean, the winemaker then, of course, became my friend, you know, and we still, I also saw him yesterday, so he tasted my wine.
What did he say? Because, I mean, your wines now are somewhat different.
Yeah. I mean, we discussed it for many years about, you know, winemaking, about wines, and so we are good friends. But at the moment, you know, I didn't know the alternative.
And so when did that alternative start to become clear? I mean, when did you start to see that there were some other options out there in terms of protocol, like how you could go about it?
When you make wine, then you have to sell it. And it was very shocking for me, because it was like being back in my old world. The idea was, okay, I left a bank where everybody is completely crazy, selling, you know, stock options, or selling, you know, making money with money. And now I'm here selling wines to people, which is crazy the same way. And, you know, which is the difference, you know? And so in those years, I was a little bit in, not in crisis, but you know, thinking what's going on
in your life,
in
mean,
my life,
like a life change.
Yeah, I found out that there was something else, and I think in 2002, and then in 2003, you know, we began to meet these people that basically were like me, small producers. Focused on, you know, organic wines.
But from outside the market, though?
Yeah. At the beginning, yes.
Because there's not so many kind of natural.
No. At that time, probably the only one was Natalino Crognaletti from Fattoria San Lorenzo, probably. And so we began to go to this small market, and meeting many people and many wine growers also from France, where probably this movement was born.
People from Beaujolais and stuff like that.
Yeah, from Beaujolais and then from Loire and then from all over. And then was the moment when the book from Nicolas Joly was translated in Italy. And the moment when Josko Gravner began to work with the amphora. So it was like a revolution stuff. You know? Everything was changing. And in 2 or 3 years, I decided, I went to France to meeting some producers and I visit Marcel Lapierre. And his wines were very shocking for me, but also Pierre Breton and in Italy, of course, Stefano Bellotti, Angiolino Maule, and many others. And so I began to work about this way of winemaking, you know. And so from 2004, actually, we began with a little bit of natural fermentation, spontaneous fermentation.
How'd that work out for you?
At the beginning was very, I had a fear, because when the idea is to control everything, you know, going in a way where the idea is, no, you are completely free, it's really difficult, you know. Because every day you are there tasting, you know, during the fermentation, oh, there is a bad bacteria, or oh, the reduction, oh, the oxidation, you know, it's difficult because it's like when you jump in the void, you don't know where you are going. So the first years were very, very tough, and also the discussions with the winemaker are very tougher and tougher, you know, because I told him, okay, let's reduce the sulfate. Oh, no, you cannot reduce the sulfate. Okay, let's use less, you know, something. Oh, no, you cannot, because otherwise the malolactic is, it's a continuous battle. But I found out that the wines had something new, something deeper, probably. Maybe the first vintages at that time were better, you know, because when you change, you have to find your way. So probably I had in the middle, I have a couple, 2 or 3 vintages that are not really as I want. But, you know, it was a learning by doing. Until I found out that everything could be more relaxed, more, you know, easier.
What were your parents like? Were they relaxed people or were they more tack people?
No. They worked all their life, you know, in very stressful jobs. And so, no, they were not very relaxed.
So this was kind of like an opposite door for you, kind of out of family life too.
They were very, very worried in a way, because of course I was living a world that was, you know, the world of everything is stable, the money comes, and you know, you can have a family, you can
yeah.
No.
And you weren't married at the time?
In 2001, but kids came later.
So there was all kinds of life changes happening around the same time?
Yeah.
But your wife was into it, the natural wine idea?
Yes, completely. Even if she maintained her job, she's completely part of La Distesa.
She tastes and says...
Yeah.
So that must be nice that you can do it together, especially if you're having arguments with your own lug. You have a partner of some kind.
Yeah. We were 2 against 1.
Right. What happens next in the story?
Slower and slower, of course. I started with 1 hectare, and then I rent a little bit piece here, a little bit piece there. So the answer from the market was good.
Local market or export market?
No, from the beginning was the export market.
Yeah.
Because you have to consider that it was very, very hard to sell real traditional wines in the region. Because in these last 20 years, everything has changed. And the taste of people switched to new wines, you know, wines that comes from a very strong winemaking. And so at the moment, people in the Marche region prefer, you know, the new styles of Verdicchio or Pecorino or even Montepulciano. And especially in the, for the white wines, it's very difficult to let understand people that this was the way that, you know, for 8,000 of years, wines was made.
The anomaly is the current situation,
yeah,
not the...
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And this is it's kind of, it sounds strange because we have always to add a word to the word wine. So it's a natural wine, it's a true wine, it's authentic wine. We make wine in the way human ever made wines, you know? It's like, you know, having the organic certification. I pay for... put, you know, a green leaves on my label, but I pay that I'm working safe,
right?
And you know, but probably it's the other way that should pay,
right? A penalty,
like, you know, a penalty, a tax, you know, a carbon tax, something, you know, because they are making pollution in doing an industrial farming, you know. But I don't want to make this, you know, fighting between the big and the small. You can be small and make a very bad farming, you know. It's not about being big and small. It's about making good wines and bad wines for me at the end.
And so the export markets that were supportive were...
I have to confess that at the beginning was very, very important. Yeah. And still now. Now everybody is looking to the export because nobody in Italy drink wine anymore. The consumption is, you know, really falling.
So you started with a hectare of Verdicchio, but
yeah.
Subsequently you started working with Trebbiano, Malvasia, and then red grape varieties.
Yeah, Trebbiano and Malvasia were there because the old vineyards were also... complanted, you know, planted with different varieties. The pure Verdicchio, the Verdicchio 100% is something that comes from probably the last two decades.
Oh, really? So it's a fairly recent thing.
Yeah. Before the DOC law, which is back to 1968, Verdicchio was completely a blend of different grapes, different varieties. So Verdicchio was for sure the most important, but there was in the blend Trebbiano, Malvasia, and also many other, like also Albana or, you know, Moscato, was very different varieties. And then when the DOC came, they said, no, it had to be at least 85% Verdicchio. The old vineyards maintain a little bit of Trebbiano and Malvasia, but then in the last two decades, it's like 100% Verdicchio. With the new clones, which are being selected in the late 80s, first years of the 90s.
So do you ever see those old bottles in the cellars of the Marche? Like, do you ever open up old wines from...
No. It's very difficult to find something because at that time, you know, Verdicchio was a very popular wine. Very, very popular.
The Amphora bottles, like that kind of Verdicchio?
Yeah, exactly. And probably with Chianti in the 60s was the most popular wine abroad, you know. White was the Verdicchio and red was the Chianti. But was a very easy, very, very easy wine, something for pizzeria, for the summer, but without any chance to age. And this probably is the reason why in the 70s and the 80s it came a very big crisis, because the image of the variety and of the wine was very, very, very low. So prices were low and people were leaving the region and all the vineyards were cut off.
But that gave you an opportunity, right? Because you could come in and get old vines, either rent or buying them.
Yeah, sure. It's an opportunity, but in another way, we lost a big, big heritage, you know, a big, big heritage. Because, for example, my old vineyard is 36 years old. It's not an old vineyard, but it is an old vineyard. It's almost impossible to find a vineyard that has more than 40, 45 years in my region now. And this is an incredible, damage, an incredible problem, because only an old vineyard can express the soil, the climate, the terroir. And this probably is why we are focusing so much on the variety. You know, you say Verdicchio and it's easier. But it's, for me, it's not the right way to communicate, you know, the region and the terroir you are living in.
So you're saying that the vines don't have the roots down into the terroir to express it, really?
Yeah, yeah.
So what is the place like? I mean, what is the topography, climate?
I am in Cupramontana, which is 500 meters. The top, the village is the top of the hill, and all the vineyards are on the slopes, north, south, and... So you may find vineyards with very different, you know, expositions and altitude, from 100 meters to 450 meters in north exposition or south exposition. And so this, it's very important to communicate this, but nobody knows it. You know, everybody think that Verdicchio is
one thing, monolith.
One thing. And also geologically, it's very interesting because it's not all the same. Basically, the hills were under the sea level between 5 million and 13 million of years ago. And so the Adriatic Sea made some, you know, regressions and movements many different times and left these sediments of clay, of sandstones. And so there are some differences in the area. The big one, of course, is Matelica, is different from Castelli di Jesi, especially in the climate. Matelica is much more inside the mountain, so it's much more cold area, and Castelli di Jesi is much more Mediterranean wine, closer to the sea, and but also geologically there are some differences.
I can see that, because it kind of reminds you of those, like, Cassis, like from the south of France, kind of Mediterranean whites, that kind of flavors of the yellow, but the scrub brush, that kind of thing, you know, in Verdicchio, I think.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But as I told you before, there is not a big focus on that. Until now, probably, it will be, I don't know. But my idea is that it's very easy focusing to the variety, and all the world probably think about Italy, about Italian wines, like only the variety and less about the places, the crew, the vineyard.
Speaking to many Italian vintners, I've often found that they don't bring up the soil type unless you ask them. Mm-hmm. Like if you say, what kind of soil is this? They'll say like, Kelkar, but that's not the first thing they talk about usually. I mean, it's a big country. There's a lot of people.
Completely true. Yeah.
Whereas I think in France, you know, sometimes you see it on the labels, you know, granite or, you know.
Yeah. I don't want to be misunderstood. I mean, for me, it's a very good thing to have all these original varieties, you know, because if you want to taste Pecorino, you have to come to the Marche region, you know. But the problem is that if you focus only on the variety, if you ask to 10 people, not only in the States or in France or in Germany, but also in Italy, where are the Marche region? Probably 8 or 9, they don't know where is the region. But probably they have drunk Pecorino and they know about the variety, which is strange.
the Marque, what's kind of interesting about it is that on one side you have Abruzzo, right? Yeah. And the other side you have the sea.
Yeah.
And you get storms from both sides, right? Like sometimes storms come through Abruzzo and go to the Marque, but mostly they come from the sea.
Yeah.
How does that affect the harvest pattern?
It's very interesting to think about that. You look at the map of Europe and you see the left part, looking the map, so the Tyrrhenian Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, with the islands, you know, Sardinia and Corsica. And it's all about red wine, you know? So Sangiovese and Grenache and Syrah and Garnacha, Cannonau, you know? It's really about the red. If you look at the right part, so the Adriatic Sea, it's like a community which is focused on white wines. You know, there is Trebbiano d'Abruzzo in Abruzzo, there is Pecorino, Verdicchio, Albana in Romagna, and then you go up and you go to Carso. You have, of course, Prosecco, you have, and then the Friuli, so, you know, Tocai, Friulano, and the Sauvignon, and then the Malvasistriana, and then all the original variety in Croatia are mainly on white, you know? And this is cool for me, because express really that climate, it's completely different. And we have the heat waves coming from Africa that goes through Sicily to Sardinia and then to south of France, and of course, Tuscany. And we have the cold winds coming from the Balkans, from in winter from Siberia, you know, coming down and just in front, they find the Marche, Abruzzo, you know. And so, all this to say that we had been a very cold region until probably 15, 20 years ago. And this is the reason why the white wines were so good and so well known.
So you don't think it's like there's a strip of underlying soil that goes down that side, like limestone on that side or something?
No, because you may find the same almost the same soil also in Lange. I mean, the Adriatic Sea used to arrive until Lange, you know, during the Miocene era and then the Pliocene era, there was sea until the Alps, you know. And over there, of course, they make red wines. So it's much more about the climate, about the cold winds, about the temperature a little bit lower. For example, in January, it snows very, very often in the Marche region. It's very difficult that you see snow in Tuscany. You know, there are 2-3 degrees of difference always.
The Marche has a high degree of state-mandated parks, right? Like there's forest preserves and parks, wild animals.
Yeah, especially in the south, but near, close to Abruzzo, there is this beautiful, beautiful park, which is called the Sibillini Park Mountains. But also in another area close to the Apennines. And there is this other beautiful park, which is the Conero Park, which is right in the middle of the sea. And it's a mountain that goes down to the sea. And it's pretty famous for a wine, which is the Rosso Conero.
So that means it's not just a monoculture, right? Like you're not just walking into vines after vines after vines. There's some mixed things going on.
Yeah. You don't look so many vineyards if you come in the Marche region. A lot of cereals, a lot of olive oil, a lot of animals. It's an heritage from sharecropping, you know.
So it's like Abruzzo, but closer to the water.
Yeah.
And maybe lower in elevation sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have the Gran Sasso, which is almost 3,000 meters high.
And so when did you start to really like your own wines?
I mean, I was in love with the 2004. That was my first vintage. But of course, it wasn't perfect. It was a very good vintage, so maybe it was good for me because of the vintage. But then probably 2010 was the first vintage that I really, really understood that my way was found.
Are those both cooler years?
Yeah. 10 for sure was... it's strange because we are talking now about cool vintage. And if you see the statistics, they are still above the average. So it means that really, really we had a switched, completely changed in the climate, in the area. So we consider cold vintage like the 10 or the 2004, which were cool, but completely normal if you see the average. But we had, 7, 3, 11, 12 that were completely out of the average, and 15 also.
When I think about the kinds of things you were saying earlier about the people that were interesting to you, usually when people express those kind of interests, they also experiment a little with skin contact or maybe have some clay in the cellar. Or were those ideas that you had at some point?
It's very easy to fall in this misunderstanding, which is, I make natural wine, so my wine should be strange, should be orange, should be fermented in clay or in strange stuff. For me, it's not about that. It's simply about making good wines. And so I didn't really, I experimented a lot, but I never thought that the way was make it strange, make it completely. There is always a tradition. There is always a line that you must follow. So for me, it's making a good wine, having respect of a tradition and having respect of the terroir. That's my way.
And so you have the three grape varieties that are white that you grow, and how do they express themselves differently, and when do you decide to blend them together or not?
I make three whites at the moment, and the first one is a Verdicchio with a small quota of Trebbiano. And there was not really a decision in doing that, but it was only that the vineyards had the Trebbiano originally planted there. And the reason why the other wines, the Riserva, is 100% Verdicchio is strange, but it's only because it's an old vineyard, but the part that was not planted with Verdicchio was planted with Sangiovese. So when we harvest that vineyard, of course, we only take the Verdicchio, the white. So this is the reason why it's 100% of Verdicchio. And then there is a third white, which is an orange wine. And I decided to make this wine because, of course, at the beginning, I told you, there was this big revolution and I was tasting all these orange wines from Slovenia, especially from Slovenia, but then from Georgia. And I tried with Verdicchio. And I have a couple of years where I made a long maceration with Verdicchio, but the wine was not good. So I never released that on the market because I was not convinced about the wine. And then I tried with Trebbiano. And Trebbiano is a strange animal because... It gives probably one of the most beautiful wine on planet Earth, which is Valentini Trebbiano d'Abruzzo.
But is that the same Trebbiano that you have?
No, it's different.
Okay.
It's different.
Because there's many, right?
Yeah, there are many. But at the same time, Trebbiano gives probably the worst grape for the worst cooperative, In a way, it's like Sangiovese. You can make... the best Brunello di Montalcino and the worst bag-in-box. And so which is the difference? Probably terroir, probably the soil, probably, the way you work, the way you make farming, And so it was interesting for me trying with Trebbiano. And so the third wine is basically is a 60% Trebbiano with a little bit of Verdicchio and Malvasia. And I must confess that Trebbiano, I felt in love with Trebbiano variety. And the last vineyard I planted was mainly Trebbiano.
But what kind of Trebbiano are you planting? Is it?
Basically, we can plant Trebbiano Toscano.
Okay.
Yeah. There is a list of variety that are allowed to be planted in the region, and there is not Trebbiano d'Abruzzo, and not, for example, you can plant Malvasia Toscana, but not Malvasia Istriana, which is strange because the Croatian is closer to market than Tuscany, that's some part of Tuscany. So it's kind of, but it's the same. You can buy a Marche Bianco IGT, but Riesling or Chardonnay, but you cannot buy a Marche Bianco IGT Verdicchio or Pecorino because are protected in the DOP, in the DOC. So it's confusing.
So was there ever a tradition like in Tuscany of blending red grapes and white grapes together, like how it used to be for Chianti? Did that ever happen with?
Not in Cupramontana. The red wine was really residual, especially after 1968. There was red wine, but red wine was consumed very, very young. In November, December, January, in the first winter, with a very, very short maceration, like a very easy wine, like a Novello, without the technique of Novello, of course, without the maceration, carbonic maceration, but it was a very easy wine. And the white was the wine that people used to drink after 1 year or more.
I still feel like there's that divide with Marque Reds, where it's either a straightforward one or a really, really complex, a lot of wood kind of one. You know, it's like the really straightforward, cheap Rosso Conero or Vernaccia Nera, and then the one that's like got the special label that's not cheap. You know what I mean? It's meant to be like
serious. I think we are still working on the red in the region, because I'm sure we can do beautiful red wines. And I'm focusing a lot on red wines in the last 5-6 years. I planted more red vineyard than white vineyard. But I think we have a lot to understand.
So do you plant the red vineyards at different exposures and different elevations?
No, I planted close to the white vineyards. But my idea is that because of the global warming, probably we are becoming more and more an area, not only for red wine, of course, but less for white wines and more for red wines. Seasons are changing dramatically. So,
if I think of white grapes that have red wine characters, like if I had my eyes closed and I tasted one, I could sometimes confuse a certain kind of Verdicchio or a certain kind of Trebbiano with a red wine.
Yeah.
Like it has that kind of structure to it, one way or another.
Yeah. I think if you pour it in a black glass, sometimes you can be confused.
So how does it work with things like yields? You said you're kind of forsaking the modern style, you know, but one of the things of that controlled modern style is often to do the green harvest and drop fruit and get more deeper yields. Are you doing the green harvest and dropping fruit, or what are you doing?
All that kind of stuff, you have to do that because you made errors before. This is my point, my idea. Probably you didn't make a right planting at the beginning, or you made a lot of fertilization, or maybe the pruning was not correct. When you have a vineyard which is balanced, you don't have to make a big work on the green harvest, or especially if you have old vineyards.
Well, that definitely makes sense, that the older vines would do less yields. Are they head-trained or are they on wires?
We have very high. It's not like Abruzzo. We don't have pergola, but we have like 1 meter and a half, maybe more, of leaves.
On wire.
Yeah. definitely. And the only vineyard that is a little bit, we call Alberello, you know, is the red one that I planted in 2009. But it's completely something new in the region.
Why did you decide to do that?
Because again, if you plant a vineyard today, you have to think what happens in 30 years or 40 years. And so more and more will be like Puglia or Sicily in the future, in the next future. So we have to, you know, reduce the water stress. And that's a way.
What kind of fruit are you getting from that vineyard now, the Alberello one?
Montepulciano, Sangiovese, and Vernaccia Nera.
But I mean, what's the quality of the fruit?
Oh, great.
Yeah?
Yeah, I have to say, yeah. I mean, I planted in 2009, so I've seen fruit in very, very dry season, like 2012. And in very, very humid and rainy season, like 2014. And I must confess that I was really impressed about the reaction of the vineyards and quality of the fruit. It's something that I found out speaking a lot with Giovanna Morganti in Castelnuovo Bernardenga.
And that's kind of her signature, that style.
Yeah, yeah.
So what did she tell you when you talked about it? Because I've never met her.
I mean, I tasted her 2002, for example, which was a difficult year in Tuscany, and was great, completely great. So the reaction of the vine is beautiful.
So for me, Montepulciano and Vernaccia Nera seem like kind of opposites.
Mm-hmm.
What are they like in the vineyard?
Like for the white, in the Marche region, we didn't have a story of a variety that was completely predominant. We had always mixed varieties for a wine. But in the last years, everyone went through, you know, the 100% Montepulciano in the south and the other percent of Sangiovese in the north, which is cool. But for me, it's riskful because we are a region with a lot of different season. It's difficult to balance the wine, you know, through the years. You have to consider that there is almost 1 month, not 1 month, but 20 days of difference in the ripeness between Sangiovese and Montepulciano.
That's a pretty serious amount of time.
Yeah. For example, in 2013, I harvested the Sangiovese. It was 25 of September, and the Montepulciano, it was 18 October. It's a long time, you know. And Vernaccia Nera, it's very late, like the Montepulciano. It's very, very late. And it's a strange variety. I cannot say to know very well, because you have to consider that Vernaccia Nera now is cultivated like 50 kilometers from the Castelli di Jesi in Macerata, around Macerata. It's the variety of Vernaccia di Serra Petrona. So I replanted the Vernaccia Nera because we made an historical study where we found out that Vernaccia Nera was planted in 200 years ago also in Ancona, near Ancona, Castelli di Jesi. And so the idea for me is to balance all this stuff. So the acidity of the Sangiovese, the color of the Montepulciano, the green tannins of the Vernaccia Nera. It's a very raw stuff, Vernaccia Nera. It's really like a wild horses, you know. And you have to find out the way. Very, very animal, you know, very spicy.
Sometimes people dry it, right? Some people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Is there any tradition of that around where you are?
No, no, no. But the reason, I think the reason why Vernaccia di Serra Petrona is a sparkling wine that comes from dried, you know, grape is that Vernaccia is a very late variety, and Serra Petrona is a very small village in the mountains with all woods around. So it's very difficult to have the perfect ripeness of Vernaccia over there. So the only way is to dried a little bit, and to manage the high acidity with the, making a sparkling wine. No? So you have sweetness that cover a little bit the acidity, and you have the sparkling that gives some bubbles to the...
freshness.
It's like a little bit like Lambrusco, I guess. No? The idea of making...
I guess, but it seems different. Like,
yeah, it is completely different. More I mean, the idea.
Right, you know, right,
the
right.
idea of the wine.
But it seems more wild somehow, usually. And yeah. like the textures are different.
Yeah. yeah.
But I've had some non-sparkling ones that were good too.
I was curious because for me, it can give a own touch to the wine, you know? Like this spicy, this green... stuff that you can taste that refresh a little bit the Montepulciano, which is very, very, you know, powerful. And
speaking about green stuff, do you ever do like whole cluster and use stems? Or
I've changed a lot the vinification with the red, and especially with the other red that I make, the easy one, I mean, which is Montepulciano Sangiovese. There is a 5% of Cabernet Sauvignon. That was my first mistake I made in 1999, was actually. But it's only one row. It was an experiment. But mainly the wine is 95% Sangiovese and Montepulciano. And in that wine, I use more and more, you know, the entire grape to give a little bit of freshness. And I love this green side that comes from.
Do Vernaccia Nera or Montepulciano give high sugars?
Montepulciano for sure, yeah. Vernaccia Nera, no. I mean, it depends because I'm still trying to understand it. So it's like, you know, when you go out the first date, and you're still to understand.
You're curious if there's going to be sugar or not?
Yeah.
I see. I think I do know that feeling.
Yeah. I'm still trying to learn about red wine. And they say it's easier to make red wine. And this probably is true. But it's very difficult to make good red wine.
What about lees? Do you leave either the red or the white on lees
yeah,
for a long
yeah,
time?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of crucial to your style for white, I think.
Yeah, I think it's very important. If you work well at the beginning, all you get from the fermentation is good. And so it should stay until the bottling, for me, this is my opinion.
Oh, so basically you rack onto bottle.
Yeah, yeah. Many people, they change from here, from this tank to the other. It's like, you know, a continuous process of clarification. I leave the wine dirty, completely dirt until the bottling.
In terms of the press, are you doing much with press wine or no?
It depends a little bit with the kind of vintage it has been, you know, because after the maceration, the skin could be very, you know, very bad, very destroyed, completely gone, and so it's better. You know, you press and you take it for home. But sometimes there is still something that you can extract. So it depends. It's something, you know, my winemaking is something really sensitive. It's really, I you know, I taste, it's something really being with the food in the... in the ground, you know.
And that's the fun part for you.
Probably. Yeah, yeah. It's completely it's a poetry, you know. It's like create something.
And so you've been doing it the way that you want to do it, at least for white, for about 10 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the next 10 years, what do you think might happen? Because it's been a lot of changes in the time that you've been there already.
You know what? I'm never satisfied, so this is a problem. It's my character, my way of being. So I'm trying to experiment. So now we have this rosé, which is not a real rosé. It's a blend of white and red grape made at you know, the ancient way, and it's new stuff, you know. So I think the idea is to become more and more like a rural community, you know. I think you cannot only make wine. I mean, we also make olive oil, we make cereals, and so the idea is to we have a music festival that it's a big happening in end of June usually, and I mean the idea is like making a community of people that loves wines but also culture, you know, culture and art and music, and so connecting people, making something that usually happened only in the big cities. In my region, the young people, they left, you know, the region because they wanted to study and to live in the big cities and to go to cinemas, to theaters, you know, to live an active life, you know. But now we can do this also in the countryside. And more, I think that the chance for the future is transform the city in a way, in a place where you can make farming, you know, like in New York City. I know that there are places, park or houses where you can, you know, cultivate tomatoes or something else, and making the, you know, something which is typical of the big cities, like festivals, like artistic performance in the countryside. So this relation between the city and the countryside, for me, it's really a challenge.
Corrado De Torre would like to connect people with wine. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Corrado De Torre of La Distesa in the Marche of Italy. This interview was made possible by Vinitaly, the world's largest wine fair, held each year in Verona, Italy. Daniel Jonas and Peter Leem have announced the third edition of La Fête de Champagne, which takes place November 3rd through the 6th of this year in New York City. La Fête de Champagne's program has always included a series of excellent educational seminars. This year they've included three standouts. The first is a tasting tour of Champagne with Peter Leem, focusing on terroir, grape varieties, viticulture, cellar practices, and producers. There will also be a dosage masterclass with Alexander Chartonia and Terry Thies, where guests will get to examine all aspects of dosage in a practical context. And there will be a tasting of Pinot Noir terroir, featuring producers who are known for their skill with Pinot Noir, including Michel Drapier, Charles Philippinat, and Jean-Baptiste Geoffroy. La Fête de Champagne will culminate with two really cool events. There'll be a grand tasting of over 100 different champagnes at the Metropolitan Pavilion on Saturday, November 5th, and there'll be a Champagne Gala luncheon at Restaurant Daniel on Sunday, November 6th. For more information or to buy tickets, visit lafetdechampagne.com. That's LAFETEDUCHAMPAGNE.com. That's lafetdechampagne.com to hear more about the third edition of La Fête de Champagne happening in November in Manhattan. Before we go, we have some people to thank. A big thank you to Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett, who wrote and performed our new intro music. Go to robmoose.com, that's Rob Moose with two O's, .com for more information about a very talented musician. Of course, we couldn't do what we do here without the help of Erin Skella, who does the warm-up segments for this show. You can find her own blog at thinking-drinking.com. And Alder Jarl's excellent website, vinography.com, V-I-N-O-G-R-A-P-H-Y, posts up write-ups and warm-ups for this show, as well as other tremendous content. We are proud to partner with Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan for our wine club, offering regularly discounted wines that we feature on this show. You can write to me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com, levy with an I, openswine@gmail.com to find out about joining our wine club. And thanks to the many of you who have already signed up. Also thanks to all of you, our audience. Together we have heard from some of the most fascinating people in wine, and they opened up their hearts and their minds to you and me. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page. Find it by searching at Drink to That Pod. You can also find us on Twitter at Drink to That Pod, or you can check out the pictures on Instagram at Levy Opens Wine. We love iTunes comments, and we love iTunes subscribers. If you subscribe, you'll see our episodes in your feed much earlier, sometimes even as much as a day or two earlier than you would otherwise, and you'll be able to listen to every episode since number one. That's about 400 episodes since we first got started. If you have an Android phone, you'll be happy to know that we're on Google Play Music as well. Our own website is alldrinktothatpod.com, I-L-L with no apostrophe, drinktothatpod.com, and you can find information there about buying a fancy IDTT t-shirt or a seasonally appropriate hoodie. You can also get information on the website about donating to the show. Donations have really kept this thing going, and you can help do that. Thank you, and see you next episode.